There's a sheet of paper at the back as you go out, near the where the drinks are when you came in. And if you're email this, if you're not on the Ian Ramsey Centre seminar email list, and you would like to be, would you please jot your email address down on that sheet of paper, and then we'll put you on the seminar list for future seminars. And I think it's just about 8:30, and you're all wonderfully on time. I think we'll make a start. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ian McGilchrist here to speak to us this evening. Really, the inspiration for this seminar really came from one extraordinary book, which has been his life's work to date. And this is it. So, his emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. And the book came to my attention because my doctoral supervisor in philosophy in the States, a very great philosopher called Eleanor Stump, she said, I just have to read this book. And I started to read it, I was amazed. Dr. McGilchrist, he takes a theme, based on a very obvious kind of question, which is a real puzzle. Why is the human brain, which is the most sophisticated object that we know of in the universe to date, why is it divided into two? Why is this masterpiece of interconnectivity divided into two hemispheres? And by this, begins to explore action, he really begins to tell the story of our interactions, of our society, and to some extent, the history of our civilization, particularly in the last few centuries. He's throwing out ideas on every page. I'm personally grateful to him because he helped me to finish a book manuscript I was working on just through one of those ideas, so thank you for that. But it's not easy to reduce it to a few words because he's throwing out ideas connecting different disciplines. And he is himself not easy to reduce in terms of his training and background. For most of our speakers, we can say what they are. But Dr. McGilchrist, this is a bit difficult. He came up to Oxford, he wanted to study philosophy and theology, and he discovered that there wasn't an honours in philosophy and theology. He ended up studying English. Then he went into philosophy, and then started to study psychology. Became interested in the structure of the brain, so he went into medicine to investigate this puzzle. Then he became interested in neuroimaging and neurology. Then he qualified as a psychiatrist, and that is, in fact, his main profession today. But he also takes an interest in poetry, art, history. I haven't yet found a subject that he doesn't know something about in the course of a two-hour dinner conversation. So would you please welcome with me Dr. Ian McGilchrist.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you for welcoming me here tonight. I'm going to try, in the course of an hour, to give some idea of some of the themes that I've been working on for some time, and their ideas were more than certainties, and I hope that they may stimulate debate. And so, in order that we should have a bit of debate, I hope there will be half an hour at the end for questions. So, as Andrew says, this is really about a book that I wrote over a long period, conceived certainly at least 20 years ago. And just to explain the title, I want to remind you of a story in Nietzsche, where he speaks of a wise spiritual master who oversaw a domain so well that it flourished and grew, and he realized that he could not actually deal with the ordering of it all himself. In fact, he had a more profound perception, which was not only that he could not, but that he ought not to become involved in certain things if he was going to be able to see the overall picture that was important to the survival of the community. So he appointed his brightest and best advisor to go about in the domain and do his work on his behalf. The outcome you can imagine, because it's quite predictable if you've lived at all, was that this advisor thought, I'm the one doing all the work, I know what I'm doing, I don't think he adds anything at all, through his misunderstanding of the limitations of his knowledge, through his arrogant disposition, he assumed the master's cloak, and the community fell into ruins, basically. So that is the story, and it rang bells for me as a metaphor of something I was discovering over those 20 years. Now, although this book is about the brain, and the brain is terribly fashionable now, it's almost a fashion accessory. Practically every subject has got to have a brain angle to it these days. And certainly I've been invited to take part in just about every activity under the sun since this book was published, in order to provide a brain angle to it. And this can become somewhat trivial. But I don't want you to think that what I'm doing is trying to tell you that the history of Western culture can be somehow reduced to the brain. In fact, my whole thesis is the exact opposite of that, that in fact it can't, and that indeed the whole reductionist enterprise is dubious. What I want to do is to use the brain to demonstrate some of the possibilities and the limitations of the way we tend to look at the world. Because this is really a book not about the brain, but about existence. Ontology, in other words, what it is to be at all. Now, this is a famous picture, of course, of M.C. Escher's, but I put it up there in order to talk about attention, which seems to me a very important aspect of the nature of the world. How we attend to something is not only governed by what it is we're attending to, clearly, but it governs the nature of what it is we find when we attend. Paying one kind of attention to something reveals something completely different from paying another kind of attention. And there may be many aspects to that, which we can't explore all of them. One I'd just like to draw to attention is the difference between something that is in the focus of attention and made explicit, and its nature when it is implicit. And many of the most important things to us in life change their nature entirely and become denatured when they're put under the hot spot of our greatest attention. So, in a way, you need to be careful what kind of attention you apply, but at the same time, you need to be responsive to what it is you find. So there's a two-way process whereby a dialogue goes on between ourselves and whatever it is that exists apart from ourselves that brings things into being. And I realise this is at odds with the two main models of our age, one of which is the scientific materialist one, actually very much out of date in science itself, as Andrew was saying, probably not really since 1850 if people believed it, but in the, curiously in the life sciences, the universe is very inanimate in this materialistically structured way. In the other sciences, people have moved on to realise that it's more complex than that. But there is that model, which is basically that the world exists apart from us, and we somehow find out what is the truth, and it has nothing to do with who is attending. Then there is the postmodern position, which is the opposite of that, really, the inverse, no more sophisticated, in fact, which is that we just make it all up. It's just something that goes on inside our heads. And presumably you're not here tonight at all, and there's no point in my giving this talk because it's just a bad dream I'm having. But I don't think that reality is like that. I think it is a dialogue. I think there is something that exists. I think how it comes into being and quite what it comes to be depends on the one who is attending. And so there is this dialogue and rapport, like things attend to one another and something emerges from it. In fact, all knowledge of things, we think that we make things certain when we know a certain thing, but all we mean when we say we know something is that we can liken it to something else that we think we know better. So it depends on a model we've already got that we're comparing it with and fitting it to. And if we compared it to another model, it would look different. In the book I just mentioned that a football match, for example, if compared to a trip to the betting shop, looks like one thing, but compared to going to church, it looks like another thing, and both of these realities are part of the experience of going to a football match. So context is everything, and that is something that really can't be emphasised strongly enough. Things change according to a context in which they lie, and when they're taken out of that context in order to be seen more clearly, you've already changed the nature of them. And by in doing that, you're in danger of being a bit like the person who tries to see what they look like when nobody's looking at them. It's something that can't be done. And there's a philosophical tradition of this. John Dewey says that the neglected complex is the greatest single disaster which Philippine can incur. I think this has a meaning in terms of things that we are understanding in science as well, in both of the level of particle physics, that a single particle doesn't exist just like a billiard ball independently of other things that are around it, or even in other parts of the universe. And the genome turns out to be of this nature as well. A lot of the puzzles about the genetic code, which turns out not have enough material in it by a very long chalk to specify the complex structures that are going on. I mean, for example, the human brain, the fetal human brain, is creating 19,000 new neurons per minute for 9 months. They've all got to be wired in a reasonably intricate way and in a structure that is very carefully specified. It's hard to know where that structure lies. I'm not suggesting that it's not there at all, but where it is must be something to do with the whole context, because we know that genes work differently in different contexts. They specify completely different things depending on the context in which they are lying. So context is the important thing, and the implicitness of something may be very may be a very important aspect of its nature. I, when I was doing English literature, I was very troubled by the fact that when one came to look at a work of art, one took something which somebody had taken immense pains to create, that was absolutely unique, that was embodied just as it was in the very words that it was, and not in a paraphrase or any other words, and in which all sorts of things were carefully implicit, and that's why they were so powerful. And then the nature of attending to it had to turn this entirely unique object into something rather general, to turn this very concrete thing into something very abstract, and to take the implicit out and make it explicit, whereby it was no longer the same thing at all. In other words, the whole had been taken to parts that actually were illusory. It didn't contain these parts. We were thinking of it like a machine, whereas Aristotle says in at least three different ways in his workings, in his works, that a work of art is like a living being. It is an organism, it's not a machine. So as a result that, I began thinking very much about how the brain helps to bring reality into being. And I was interested in what I learned when I heard a doctor called John Cutting speaking at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. He just finished writing a book called Cerebral Hemisphere and Psychiatric Disorders, which is still the sort of greatest work on the right hemisphere, a classic book by AUP. And at medical school, I've been told that more or less all the interesting things happened in the left hemisphere, all things that really signaled the human status went on in the left hemisphere. In the right hemisphere, nobody really knew what it was that it was doing. It did something to do with emotion or something, but nobody really knew. Zaniger, a famous neuroscientist, said that the right hemisphere on its own was about as intelligent as the average chimpanzee. Well, I think he actually underestimated the intelligence of chimpanzees as well, but he certainly underestimated what it was the right hemisphere was doing. So, in this lecture, I heard all sorts of things that rang a bell for me, which was that the right hemisphere understood implicit meaning, where the left hemisphere tended to take things literally and understand language very well, but according to a set of rules. That the right hemisphere was the main mediator of metaphor, of sense of humour, of tone, of empathy, and that a whole lot of things that I had understood were missing when one started taking a work of art apart and trying to understand it were mediated by the right hemisphere. So I began to think more about this, talked to him, we did some research together, and I spent many years federally gathering material about differences between the hemispheres, which is not a topic that's at all respectable in neuroscience today. I mean, you can more or less, I stuck my head in the lion's mouth, because you can just write off your career if you start talking about hemispheres, because all scientists just know Like Lewis Walford, who didn't need to look at the evidence because he just knew that Peter Sheldrake was wrong when he said that animals can telepathise. Scientists just knew that the hemispheres were not a useful way to approach the brain. But it can't go away that easily. People talk about dichotomising, but there isn't a dichotomy here that I made up. Nature dichotomised before us. This brain, which, as Andrew says, is the most complex structure in the universe, is all about making connections. So why is it profoundly divided? And you could say, well, here you're just looking at the top of the brain, for those who are not familiar with looking at brains, and the right hemisphere has been pulled aside to show the corpus callosum, which is the band of hemispheres which communicates between the two hemispheres. And you might say, well, it's just the way the brain grows, and it's got this communication channel, that's fine. But there are a couple of puzzles here. The first is that with evolution, the ratio of the size of the corpus callosum to the cerebral hemispheres has got smaller, not larger. And the puzzle becomes more complicated when you realise that at least one of the important functions of the corpus callosum, if not the main one, is to inhibit the other hemispheres to make sure that it doesn't get involved in what's going on in the contralateral hemisphere. So there's something interesting going on here which suggests that two things have to be kept apart. And this is really just to show that it's not a necessary consequence of embryology. This is the neural tube in, I think, 33 days. And it shows that there are parts of the brain, there's this bit here, the midbrain, for example, where, as the myelin keflon, where if you want more volume, you just expand. But as you can see at the top there, these things that look like Mickey Mouse ears are actually what are going to end up being the cerebral hemispheres. And they're already budding off separately. They then fold up and become the brains we recognise it. So they start off at a very early level, showing that they need to be separated out and bud off in that way. When you come to look at the human brain, you notice that another aspect that's very interesting of the structure of the brain is the size of the frontal lobe. A lot of people who are not, again, familiar with the brain might think the frontal lobe was just a little bit of your brain up in front of your forehead, but it isn't actually. It's about 35% of the volume of the brain. And even an intelligent animal like a dog has about 7% of its brain is frontal lobe. So the fact that it's being so extensive is remarkable. In fact, the great apes have almost as extensive a frontal cortex. In our case is that we have more white matter in ours, which is significant. Actually, it's interesting because white matter is about connectivity. Anyway, when you come to look at the human brain, you notice that it is divided and has these very large frontal lobes. I wanted to understand, obviously spurred on by these hints that I got from John Cutting about the nature of the two cerebral hemispheres, to see what it was that in origin, i.e. evolutionarily, had started to differentiate. Why had we differentiated our brains in this way? There must be an evolutionary reason for it. And so I thought a good idea would be to have a look at what we know about birds and animals, because they too have divided brains. And it turns out that in birds and animals, there's a quite reliable finding that they use their two hemispheres in different ways. And the easiest way to explain this is to think about a bird trying to pick out a grain of seed against the background of pebbles or grit. It has to, first of all, know what it is that it's looking for, and then identify it carefully against the background and pick it out, that detail, accurately. But there's a problem here, because if it's entirely taken up with doing that, it won't survive, because it needs at the same time to have the broadest, most open attention to anything else that might exist without preconception about what it might be. On the one hand, it needs to have an already committed attention to something that it knows it's interested in and can pick out and use. And an open, uncommitted attention to the rest of whatever it is that exists. And we see that this is, generally speaking, true of birds and small animals. There have been studies in a whole series of different types of animals which show that, broadly speaking, this is true. And what is going on in the case of the right hemisphere is not just looking out for predators, but also looking out for mates, for conspecifics that one might want to have a relationship with. So it seems already that the right hemisphere's interest is in its relationship to whatever it is else is out there, whether it be a threatening something or a welcome something. Whereas the left hemisphere is focused on getting something that is needed. And both these things need to happen. Both of them are important. But you can see that one kind of attention is relatively constricted compared with the other. Now, when you come to the significance of the frontal lobes, what do the frontal lobes add? Well, they add everything, basically. Now, they really are what make us human, because they enable us to stand back from the world. What effectively the frontal lobes do is to enable us to put distance between ourselves and the world, not to be just like machines that react to stimuli, but to be able to put together a broader picture and decide, I think on this occasion I'm not going to react to that, I'm going to forego that particular pleasure at the moment in order to achieve something greater in the longer run. And so there is something that is very important, the evolution of understanding, a bit of distance from the world. And a good image here is that of reading a book. If you've got a book and you hold it right up in front of your eyes, you can't read the text. If you hold it too far away, you can't as well. There is a right distance for appreciation of it. And there is a right distance for appreciating the things that we attend to, depending on what they are. A sort of necessary distance from the world. Now, because it's distance, it's often thought of that this means a kind of cold, manipulative, detached distance. And it's certainly true that that is one of the functions of the frontal lobes. It's in fact one of the things that the left frontal lobe is particularly good at giving us. The intelligence that scientists refer to as Machiavellian, that's the word that's always used, that we are Machiavellian, which of course implies that we tread on the heads of our grandmother if it suited us, and that we're really all at loggerheads with one another, and what we're out to do is to simply get the best for ourselves and the devil take the hindmost. But actually, something more sophisticated happens when you stand back from the world, because you also learn for the first time to be able to have empathy with the world. If you're very close to it, and as an animal might be, and it perceives a threat, it's just going to bite. But if you're able to stand back and think, actually, maybe this is somebody or a creature with whom I could have a relationship that has a kind of internal, has a kind of life like my own, then you can see that it is a ground for having an empathic relationship with something. And so I would say that it gives rise not just to the world of Machiavelli, but the world of Erasmus, the ability to tolerate, to be understanding in a more empathic sense. Now, if you're going to stand back from the world, and particularly if you're going to be able to use it, you need to be able to chart what you see in an easy-to-use and memorable form. You need to be able to put labels on things so that you can clearly remember what they are and start to categorize the world so that every encounter is not just a fresh encounter with experience, but it enables you to say, oh, that's one of those, so I can put it there. And this is a bit like a map. It's a bit like creating a map of the world. And in this way, it's like the map that's in a general's headquarters. It's no good the general knowing all about all that's going on the terrain out there and all the plant species and every tiny bit of the contours. He needs to know certain important facts, and these are marked by the flags on the map. So the map, by being less than the world, is more useful than the world. And so less, in this case, can be more. But the problem comes when you mistake the map for the world. and think that that actually is the reality. Just because it's very useful and very helpful doesn't mean to say that it contains the full picture. Now, one of the things we use to map the world is language. It's obviously, if you like, a sort of virtual version. It's a sort of simulacrum of reality. We're able to conjure up most of our experience in a simplified form, and a lot of things get missed out with language and are notoriously difficult to use language to convey, and that's perhaps where the right hemisphere comes in. But in any case, language is something which maps the world. And one of the key differences between the right hemisphere's version of the world and the left hemisphere's version of the world, when we talk in such terms, is that the left hemisphere's understanding is representational. And representation suggests something that was present but isn't now. It's something, so the immediacy of experience is something that is better captured by the non-conceptualized workings of the right hemisphere, which is inferior to the left hemisphere in doing that particular task of presenting it in a conceptualized form. But again, there is a difference between the thing itself and the representation of it, and the one mustn't be mistaken for the other. Carrying on looking at the structure of the premise, can he do that? There is another oddity or observation, which is that the brain is asymmetrical. And in medical school, I learned about the fact that the left hemisphere had a sort of expansion posteriorly. This is looking up at the base of the brain. So, slightly confusingly, the left hemisphere is on the right, and the right is on the left. But if you're looking up, that's the front, that's the back. And over here, towards the back of the left hemisphere, you can see that the brain is broader. And this was said to be due to language, which was the thing that was unique to humans and that made us stand apart from the rest of the living world. Now, in fact, in many ways, language is not what makes us stand apart from the living world, because other creatures have languages of a kind. But one knows what is meant here. And there is a problem, though, with accepting that this is an area that is expanded because of language. The idea, obviously, is that language is an enormous system. It's better kept under one roof, so it would better be in one hemisphere or the other, and it just happened to end up in the left hemisphere, where there was plenty of room. That's the story that was fed to me. But in fact, that can't be right. Because first of all, we know that quite a lot of language goes on in the right hemisphere. So if it was terribly important to keep it all under one roof, so to speak, why divide it? And certain very important aspects of language go on in the right hemisphere. For example, although both hemispheres have an understanding of vocabulary and syntax, the vocabulary of the left hemisphere is much greater, and the syntax of the left hemisphere is much greater than that of the right. But a lot of the meaning of what we say, in fact, I would say all the overall meaning of what we say in context, comes from the right hemisphere. It is the one that sees things in context and understands metaphorical meaning, implicit meaning, and so forth. So that, you know, if I say it's very hot in here tonight, the right hemisphere understands could we open a window, but the left hemisphere just thinks about conveying helpful meteorological data. So there's different ways of thinking about the two, about language. So that's a problem. But there is another problem, which is that the great apes, orangutans and chimpanzees and gorillas, also have this expansion here, but they definitely don't have language. I mean, the best that's been achieved with chimpanzees is probably the case of Washoe, who spoke 130 words. But in fact, most people in this room probably have a vocabulary of about 70,000 words. So the difference is enormous. And yet the expansion exists just the same. And also, I mean, the skulls of fossilized skulls of pre-linguistic man seem to show this expansion as well. So that can't be what it's about. And another interesting thing is that if you look here, there is also an expansion at the right frontal cortex. And in fact, what seems to have happened is that it has expanded here and slightly overlapped and protruded behind the right hemisphere on the left. And here has slightly protruded over and protruded forwards on the left hemisphere and at the right frontal pole. So it's as though somebody got hold of the brain from below and given it a sharp twist clockwise. And that seems very mysterious because if you just wanted to expand the brain, and it really didn't matter which side it was on, you wouldn't have these differences. The skull in which the brain is contained is symmetrical. The box is symmetrical, so the brain inside it should be symmetrical too. But it isn't. Started me thinking about, well, why are these various expansions there? Because that expansion in the right frontal pole is also there in the great ape. And what goes on in that particular part of the brain? One of the things that we know that goes on there is empathic connectedness with the world. So a sort of relational consciousness, which is able to create the sort of bonds that are important, that exist between human mothers and their children, and between the primate mothers and their offspring. And they show the beginnings of empathy, and Francis Wilde has written very well about all this, and people probably know his work. And they have this area that is expanded, and interestingly, it's the biggest expansion in the whole brain, bigger even than the so-called language expansion, which makes it all more surprising that I never heard about it until I started researching this area. It wasn't mentioned in medical school at all. Probably because people weren't interested in those days in that particular area. The psychological area of empathy, and it's become very much more fashionable lately. Now, when you come to think about language, if the brain was expanded in creatures that don't have language, what was it really expanded for? If you image the brains of great apes, you find that in this area they're doing conceptual thinking. And so it seems to me that the expansion at this point is not really for language as such, but for a certain kind of abstracted, conceptualized thinking. And language is a very interesting thing because it has origins in an attitude to the world. What we've suggested is that the two hemispheres hold different attentions, the origins of different attentions, different types of attention to the world, and that therefore they create rather different phenomenological worlds. And it would be worth thinking a little bit about what those are before going on to talk about language. Shown in that picture, you probably automatically see, most people here will see, an H and a 4. And that's because there's a hierarchy of attention. We see the whole before we see the parts. We don't put things together from the parts. Interestingly, people with schizophrenia tend to see, don't worry if you do see it this way, it doesn't mean you're schizophrenia. They tend to start from the parts and build the whole. Which is interesting because in schizophrenia, subjects seem to have a lot of deficits which are similar to the deficits that occur in people with right hemisphere brain damage. So the parts are subordinate in a normal hierarchy of attention to the whole. And if you think about it, the right hemisphere gives the whole picture. The left hemisphere attends to this and this and this and this and has to put it together from the parts. That has consequences which are borne out by research. You would anticipate that, therefore, new experience came to the right hemisphere first, if you like, was processed in, understood by the right hemisphere before the left. And this is a fact. It's not something, just a supposition. Alcohol and Goldberg, a very important neuroscientist, American neuroscientist, will be familiar to anybody in the group who is a neuroscientist, did a series of experiments looking at the way new experience of any kind, new words, new images, new skills, new everything were processed by the brain. And they came, they were first when they were unfamiliar, processed more favourably by the right hemisphere, and then they became the problems of the left hemisphere as they became more familiar. So this ties up with Ramachandran's idea that the right hemisphere is the devil's advocate. It's the one that's on the lookout for something that is other than what you might be familiar with, or other than what you might expect. Which, of course, again, one would expect if the right hemisphere is the one that's on the lookout, as we found it was in birds and animals. So new experience tends to come to the right hemisphere because it has a broader sphere of attention, and new things tend to come from the peripheries of attention. So they're bound to be picked up first, if you like, on the whole, by the right hemisphere. So newness is something that is more vivid in the right hemisphere, and then that newness goes when it's represented. It's already familiar in the left hemisphere. The context in which something lies is, of course, only seen if you see the whole picture. And in fact, something can be only understood by seeing the context. For example, there is no way that you can put together this blotch in the abstract and that blotch in the abstract and that blotch and organise them and go, oh, I know what we've got there. We've got a Dalmatian dog sniffing at the crossroads of pathways in the shade of a tree. There is absolutely no way the brain can do that. It's got to have an aha moment when the whole picture suddenly reveals itself to be what it is. And that is right hemisphere attention. That is what's known, of course, as Gestalt. And that's one of the few ideas of the old ideas that were kicking around 30, 40 years ago about the difference between the hemispheres that is really has been pretty much stood up over time. Most of the others have... It's really turned out that it's much more complex than that. It's not that the two hemispheres do different things. You know, one does language and reason, and the other one does emotions and imagery or something. Because they're both involved in everything, absolutely everything. It's just that quite reliably and consistently they have a different take on it. Because they're attending to it in a different way. So the left hemisphere's world tends to be more this one that's new, rather than familiar or represented, that is understands the whole context, that understands the implicit meaning of things rather than what's made explicit and brought into the focus. And it's more connected with the body, it's the place in the brain, the right temporal parietal region has the parietal cortex, has the body image, which is not a picture, a visual image, it's something much more sophisticated than that. It's multimodal, it's an image of the body in all senses. And it has closer connections with the lower, so-called more primitive areas of the brain, the limbic system and the diencephalon and the hypothalamic pituitary axis. It also understands individuals. There's some lovely cases of people who have had right hemisphere strokes and can no longer understand individuals. They understand categories of things, but they can't tell the individuals within them apart. And there's a whole body of literature on this, and what it seems is that as the distinctions get finer and finer between individuals, they're more and more better dealt with by the right hemisphere. Gross categories of things are quite well dealt with by the left hemisphere, but the finer distinctions by the right. And there's a famous paper of a farmer who had a right hemisphere stroke who used to be able to tell his cows apart. And after the stroke, he could tell whether they were Frisians or Jerseys, but he just couldn't tell who they were anymore. And that goes perhaps with the right hemisphere's gift for understanding faces. I mean, just think how important that is, how much of the human meaning of our lives is conveyed in minute changes in a human face. And these changes are both better understood by the right hemisphere and are more subtly expressed using the right hemisphere of the brain. Another aspect of this is I'm not going to talk about emotions, they don't have emotions, and it would be another talk on its own to talk about the different timbres of emotion in the two hemispheres, but broadly speaking the right hemisphere seems to have a great affinity for sadness and melancholy, and the left hemisphere for a sort of optimism which is often unrealistic. People who lose the right hemisphere tend to have quite over-optimistic self-image. They tend to, if asked to rate themselves on various factors, and then the scores compared with people who know them, they've got a very shiny view of themselves. Whereas when people have damage to the left hemisphere, they tend to be a little bit on the negative side about themselves, but far more in keeping with the realistic view. One quite important difference is this business of building things up from the parts to the whole suggests a way of understanding things by the model of the machine. And it is interesting that the left hemisphere is particularly adept at learning machines and tools. And machines and tools are coded, as neuroscientists say, preferably in the left hemisphere. And there's been at least 8 mirror imaging studies I know that have confirmed that this is an absolutely solid bias of the left hemisphere towards tools and machines. And so strong is it that even in a left-hander who is actually using their right hemisphere to manipulate tools and machines with their left hand in daily life, they nonetheless code tools and machines in the left hemisphere. So there's a difference here between things that are living, which tend to be constantly chained, evolving, and are hard to break up into parts. That image of the world as something that's interconnected, flowing, growing, never precise, never pinned down, and the right hemisphere, which is much more tolerant of uncertainty and ambiguity, and the left hemisphere's need for what is certain because it needs to pin things down. So it's with the left hemisphere that we grasp things with the right hand, we pin them down and use them, and it's also with the left hemisphere that those aspects of language, the labelling, the semantic labelling goes on, with which we say we grasp what something is. So there's a difference in the take that the two hemispheres have on the world, which is quite significant when you come to think about the phenomenological world that they convey. And as a result of this, both music and time are better understood by the right hemisphere. There are aspects of music is quite complicated actually, because it turns out that professional musicians tend to use their left hemisphere more to understand music, and there are at least 3 interesting possible reasons why that might be. But for most people, almost all of music is understood by the right hemisphere. Only rhythm is probably more processed by the left hemisphere. And even there, complex syncopated rhythms tend to be more processed by the right hemisphere. But certainly melody and harmony are very much right hemisphere dependent. And that is interesting in the history of language, because there are arguments about where language came from. Did music evolve from language? Did language evolve from music? And that again is a whole other talk, really. And there may be people in this room who are very knowledgeable about this area, which is quite controversial in anthropology. But there are good reasons to believe that music actually came before language. One of them is that, I think it's a bit too complicated to go, that's a bit of a cul-de-sac. Anyway, we can come back to the people who are in this. But anyway, the body of evidence that suggests that we were equipped for musical sound before we had the language. And the question arises, why do we need language? And most people would say, well, we need it to communicate. But in fact, lots of animals communicate clearly very well without language, and even quite sophisticated and complex problems can be conveyed without language. And pre-linguistic children can manage without language, and even people who've lost language through a stroke can convey things. So it doesn't seem that it's quite as simple as that. It certainly exists. It helps to make communication more precise, but it isn't the basis of communication. And it isn't also the basis of thought. People think that we can't think without language, that used to be believed, but this is clearly not the case. There are tribes of Amazonian Indians who only have words for 1, 2, and 3, but they can perform mathematics as well as their French-speaking counterparts. using numbers that are much bigger. They have no words for these, but they can think of it. They have no words in which to express the idea of recursive infinity, but they do nonetheless understand recursive infinity. And people who have semantic don't lose the capacity to reason or to do mathematics. In fact, they can often do it extremely well. So language is not essential to either thought or communication in brief. So why do we have it? Well, I think because the agenda of the left hemisphere is essentially to manipulate the world, to use it. And we can't use it effectively if we can't get together on a project about something that's not there, or someone who isn't there who's going to do some work for us. So if we want to build an empire or expand what we're expand our influence, if we want to work together on a project with people who aren't there, we need language to convey ideas out of the present situation. As long as there's an I in our relation there, we don't need language. In fact, often language gets in the way of the most intense I in our communication, which is too subtle for language and breaks down. Whereas for getting together in order to achieve a goal, then language is obviously a useful tool. Now, I don't know what we have time to look at here. I think it would be useful, probably, because it's sounding rather vague at this stage, we should read a couple of passages from the book where I wrote ways in which the left and right hemisphere view reality. And these are, if you like, very concrete instances of the overall take that they have on the world. Remember I said that the left hemisphere tends to see things more mechanistically and the right hemisphere is more living. Well, if somebody had a right hemisphere stroke, they are dependent on their left hemisphere to construct the world. And this phenomenon can be seen on any general medical ward where somebody's had a right hemisphere stroke. It's extremely common. After a right hemisphere stroke, if you ask people to, certainly if it's in the right temporal parietal region, if you ask people to copy diagrams, they will copy only the right half of it, because the right visual field is processed by the left hemisphere. And now the left half of the world, processed by the right visual field, has gone AWOL, doesn't exist. If the stroke is in the other side, in the left hemisphere, you get a complete picture of the world, because the right hemisphere gives a whole picture of the world, not just the left half, but the whole thing. But the left hemisphere is only interested in the bit of the world that it can use, namely the right half. And this phenomenon is so extreme that patients will not just not see things that are on the left, but they will ignore them. They'll ignore the left-hand side of their body and say that they, for example, won't wash it or won't dress it on occasion. Or they won't attend to people who are standing over on the left-hand side. So part of the world goes away. It has to be reconstructed, if it exists at all, purely by the left hemisphere, because the right hemisphere can't do that part of reality anymore after a stroke. So here's somebody after a right hemisphere stroke talking about their own body. This is reported by Ehrenbaut, who was a German neurophysiologist in the 1930s. Where the left half of his chest, abdomen, stomach should be, that's the bit over on the left, now just being provided by the left hemisphere, he's got only a wooden plank. It goes right down to his anus and is divided into compartments by transverse planks. Food doesn't follow the usual path from the stomach through the intestines. It gets sucked into the compartments of the scaffolding and it falls through the hole at the bottom of the framework. All this is only on the left side. On the right, the organs are all perfectly in place. I thought that was quite a dramatic demonstration of that. And another odd thing that happens when people have a right hemisphere stroke is they have a phenomenon of denial of the problem. They don't seem to acknowledge that something is wrong. But this is in keeping with this over-optimistic view of the world, that if it's not something of which the left hemisphere feels it's responsible, it just denies that it denies any knowledge of it or ownership of it. So if somebody's had a right hemisphere stroke, they may find that their left arm is not working. Now, you think you'd be pretty much aware of that if your left arm wasn't working. And certainly if it's the other way around, you've had a left hemisphere stroke and your right arm isn't working. People complain bitterly about the loss of the use of their right arm. But the other way around, it doesn't seem to happen. And this is a very striking little exchange between an examiner and a patient. This is a patient who's had a right hemisphere stroke again. Examiner, whose is this? Patient, it's not mine. Whose is it? It's my mother's. How on earth does it happen to be here? I don't know, I found it in my bed. How long has it been there? And so on. And there are lots of examples of this where somebody has a stroke and they just disown the left hand part and say it belongs to the person in the next bed. Or in one case it belongs to a petit neighbour in the bed. A white woman thought hers belonged to a petit neighbour in bed with her. I mean, how bizarre is that? But this is not a person who's got a psychotic illness. In everything else you ask them, they would answer completely irrationally. And then a particularly interesting little experiment was done by a famous neuroscientist called Marcel Kinsporn with a chap called Degin in Russia, where they gave ECT, which is a treatment for depression that's not as barbaric as its reputation, but it involves giving a general anaesthetic and passing an electric shock through one or other hemispheres of the brain. It's a very effective treatment for intractable depression. But after the treatment, for about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, the half of the brain that's been treated doesn't really function very well. So in that little window, you can see what the world of just one hemisphere is like. Now, when they did this, they did a series of experiments asking people to examine syllogisms, false syllogisms. So a false syllogism is one in which the structure of the thing seems to be correct, but one of the premises is obviously wrong. So take this example. Major premise, all monkeys climb trees. Minor premise, the porcupine is a monkey. Well, clearly it isn't. Implied conclusion, the porcupine climbs trees. Unbelievably annoyingly, there are porcupines that climb trees, but actually these experiments didn't know that, so that's a theory. For the purposes of arguing, the porcupines are not arboreal creatures, right? Now, well, does it or doesn't it, you see? There's two ways of looking at this situation. And each hemisphere has its own way of approaching this. At the outset of their experiment, when the intact individual is asked, does the porcupine climb trees, she replies, using, of course, both hemispheres, it doesn't climb, the porcupine runs on the ground, it's prickly, it's not a monkey. During experimental temporary activation, the left hemisphere of the very same individual, this is not a different experimental subject, it's the same person, replies that the conclusion is true. Porcupine climbs trees, since it's a monkey. When the experimenter asks that, is the porcupine a monkey, she replies that she knows it's not. But when this is presented again, however, although a little nonplussed, she replies in the affirmative, since that's what's written on the card. But when the right hemisphere of the same individual, this is the very same person on another day, having had ECT applied to the other side, is asked if the syllogism is true, she replies, how can it climb trees? It's not a monkey, it's wrong here. So, what I think one can see here, Sasha, there's a whole series of these different false syllogisms, and overall what seems to happen is that the left hemisphere observes the internal structure of the system to be the important thing. If we're given this and we're given that, then that follows and that's the reality. In other words, the representation on the card is more important than the presence, the thing that we actually know from our experience. Now that is a very profound thing, because it seems to me that in the world in which we live, we've come through the elevation of a certain kind of rationalistic processing, which is not always entirely reasonable. I would make a distinction between being rationalistic and being reasonable, which is an ancient one, and exists in German. They have two different words, Verstand and Vernunft, for these types of reason. But from that kind of reasoning, which really was the sort of child of the Enlightenment, we reached a point where we think that if we've got a system that works very well for certain purposes, the things that don't fit with that system simply can't be true. They simply don't exist or aren't right. And a lot of people philosophise about the nature of life and the nature of the world and our relationship with it on that basis. I want to just say a little bit about that. In the second half of this book, the first half of this book, I sort of looked at in very much greater detail and with lots and lots of evidence. So people, you know, if you think I'm glibly generalising here, I hope you won't find that if you read the book, because there's a lot of evidence there, and I'm very happy to be taken up on it where I've missed evidence. And there's discussions in the footnotes and bits where it needs to be sort of more fine-tuned. But I looked at the evidence about the two sides of the brain, and I suggest that they give rise to two kinds of chronological worlds. One of them, mechanistically structured, ordered, categorised, abstract, but essentially lifeless, and only giving us information about what it already knows. The right hemisphere has something which is reaching out tentatively towards something that it understands, but it hasn't yet got a language to sort of capture or to pin down. So in philosophical terms, one of them is opening up to a possibility, the other is narrowing down to a certainty. And both of these things we need in order to live. I'm not decrying the importance of this process. It's just that it can be very misleading, it can be in denial. It doesn't know what it doesn't know. There was an article by Stanley Fish recently called "Does Reason Know What Reason Doesn't Know?" which is really making the same point. What he meant was rationality, not reason in my sense. So, I'm going to spin through these quickly because they're kind of fun. These are a tree drawn on the left by both hemispheres, in the middle by the left hemisphere. Look what a wizened thing that is, and then the more exuberant right hemisphere. Tree, same thing with flowers, they're reduced to symbols. Really, just geometrical symbols there by the left hemisphere. Again, this is to show the lack of depth with the view of the left hemisphere. It doesn't seem to understand, because of course it's interested in representation, which tends to be two-dimensional, over the three-dimensional depth of reality, which draws an interconnectedness with, or relational consciousness with, the world around us. And these are the symbolic reductions of a cube, a table, a tree, a person, and a flower. This is quite interesting because it's from the book of Gazzaniga and Ledoux, and it shows before an operation for commissurotomy where the two hemispheres are divided, the attempt by the left hand and the right hand to draw a cube. Well, obviously the right hand does it better, the left hand's not far behind. When they're separated, the left hand does a large exuberant cube, which is in three-dimensional depth. But the right hemisphere does that, yes, and the left hemisphere, the right hand, can only do a flat diagram. It hasn't got this sense of the depth of reality, only its flat representation. And this is really to suggest that attention is something that might actually give life to something. Tendering means to reach out a hand towards. And there's a lot about, you know, how the hand is there for grasping. And it is. It's there to pin things down and to take things for ourselves. But it's also there to attend to something, it's also to give life to it. And this is a famous image, of course, from the Sistine Chapel, of God apparently giving life to the human form by reaching out a hand to it. And here is a counterpart of the resurrection of the dead from the Church of St. Saviour in Hora in Istanbul, which I found very moving in real life, which shows Christ sort of more or less yanking like a whirlwind going through and sort of picking up the bodies of suffering humanity and pulling them out of the grave. So the hand can grasp but to good ends as well as to bad. And depending on how you look at the world, you can see the world built up from parts, that we actually do things for our own use and pleasure. And this is the message that we now have. That in fact all the higher things, like this is a hierarchy of values after the German philosopher Scheler, and what is really suggesting, he had this hierarchy which is basically that use and pleasure come at the bottom, values of vitality or the Lebenswert are sort of values like courage and magnanimity and generosity and so on with their opposites, and values of the intellect are things like intelligence, justice, a sense of beauty, and their opposites. And the top one is the holy. Now, in the world that we now belong to, the one that's at any rate still enthralled to scientific materialism and sees everything built up from the bottom, we
we see not these values, you know, the values of beauty and pleasure serving those of vitality and those of the intellect, serving ultimately the holy, but the opposite, the sort of Dawkins story, that actually all these things only exist in order to make us more useful and to add pleasure and utility to life. So things work the opposite way. The second half of the book, which I've got 2 minutes to talk about, so I'm not going to, is really a sort of history of Western world, looking first of all at the ancient world, then at the Renaissance and at the Enlightenment, and the Reformation, and the Renaissance and Reformation, and the Enlightenment and Romanticism, and the modern world, modernism. And really suggesting where we see the patterns of relationship with the two phenomenological worlds of the two hemispheres. It might sound a bit reductive, but I think it isn't, I'd be prepared to defend it. It's really about understanding that we are all the time juggling two ways of looking at the world. A lot of philosophical questions boil down to which way of looking at the world, the left hemisphere or the right, are you actually giving more importance to. And in different points in civilization, we have managed to balance these very well, as we need to do in our own lives. And these have often been the most productive times in our civilization, but there's been a tendency in every case, in the ancient Greek world, in the Roman world following the Augustan era, and then after the Renaissance, as we get into the more reductionist way of looking at things in the Enlightenment, of the shift always being further and further towards the world of the left hemisphere. And there's a reason, I think, for that. Firstly, it's a very simple model. And as I say, if you start to believe it's true, you get trapped into it. It's like a hall of mirror. It's very hard to break out of it. Everything gets reinterpreted in terms of the things that you already know. So you only know more about what you know. You can't break out of it very easily. Secondly, I think the left hemisphere, I say it's a bit like the Berlusconi of the brain, because it owns media. It's the one that does all the talking about the world. It's the one with which we rationalise and think and talk about our experience, and therefore we become more and more convinced by the propaganda. We discount more and more, in other words, to be a bit more serious about it, we tend to discount the things that can't be dealt with in those terms. And I think it is a self-reflexive thing. This is really just showing that until the time of the Renaissance, we painted what we knew, not what we saw. And we knew that bishops were more important than this little chap on his horse. And as time goes on, we start finding a world with which there are great perspectives which connect us to the world. So a perspective of time represented here by the ancient sarcophagus, the Roman sarcophagus near where the Christ child is born, despite the fact that the shepherds here are wearing Florentine costumes. But there's a sort of sense of the depth of the world, which is also the eye being taken off to follow these people who are coming to us out of the painting. This, of course, is a Renaissance painting. And here, from the Ashbolian just down the road, there's this wonderful picture by Claude, which to me illustrates the significance of depth. There's about five separate depths behind depth behind depth, which draw us famously into, as the Romantics eulogised Claude for doing this, drew us into the world of the painting. You can skip over those. That's really about the separation of the head body that goes on in the Enlightenment. Obviously, the French Revolution perfected a technique for that. But interestingly, Descartes, when he was buried, I mean, I think God has a sense of humour, but when Descartes was buried, his head was separated from his body, and spent a long time being shipped around Europe in various boxes, and is still, I think, not reunited with his body. This is just a picture to remind me of the, to say something about Romanticism and its ability to understand opposites, really, that a thing and its opposite can be true at the same time. Isaiah Berlin says, you know, the three building blocks on which all Western thought are built are the premises that all knowledge is in principle compatible with all other bits of knowledge, and that we can convey it to other people, which clearly we can't, we can only draw things out from other people, and that these things should not conflict with one another. So things should be knowable and never conflict with one another, but make new that innocence and experience often overlap. So No, we really are. This is the Hall of Mirrors in which we now find ourselves. I think a world in which representation has taken over. The things that used to lead us out of our mental world and the natural world, most of us know that in the West, very few of us live in daily contact with the natural world, which gives us hints of something beyond our disembodied mentation. We're mostly out of touch with the roots of our cultures because we've migrated and moved to towns and mixed our culture so much that we no longer have a sense of that. We're alienated largely from the experience of the body because we mainly live in a very sedentary and sort of artificially contained sort of world. And I believe art and religion have been undermined in our era by various kinds of ironization, which suggests that they're just manifestations, representations on the surface of things. Reality is painted onto the windows, there's nothing behind them. So that's some of the aspects. There were some things I was going to say, but I'm going to stop now because I think we all have questions. There were some things I was going to say about the theological connection, if somebody wants to talk about that.